Well, there's a lot of, yeah, I mean.
Well, the word is, the verb.
We'll make sure you still.
I have, we could do one.
We're gonna open our Senate Education Committee on Thursday, April 2nd. It was nice I didn't have April 1st because everybody would have laughed if I was having opening.
You should have been in judiciary yesterday.
No, you should have been.
Thanks.
And with that, we might as well just go. We are going to, just so people know, set aside the work session, the one bill that we were gonna work, that we brought carried over, 619. And we'll go from there. So we will start out with a motion to introduce a committee bill. So we'll open a work session for the purpose of introducing a committee bill. And with that, Senator Canope.
Chair Roble, I move that LC 4177, dated March 2015, be introduced as a committee bill. I'm about 100 years behind, apparently.
I feel better. You make me feel better. Yeah. And I've had some troubles with those comments of myself. So Senator Canope moves that LC 4177, dated March 30th, 2015, be introduced as a committee bill. We'll have a short just explanation of what the bill does. And Senator Canope, do you care? You don't care. Okay. So any discussion on the introduction, recognizing that voting for this does not indicate whether you are in favor or opposed, it just puts it in the play. It was a bill that some people asked, and Senator Canope and I agreed to put it in. So with that, is there any discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, we clearly don't have enough bills yet. So
exactly. That was the hope.
Nothing to do.
Let's get on that.
Is there any opposition to introduction of this bill? Seeing none, it has been introduced. Next, we will close the work session for introduction of committee bills, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 187. Do we want to start that one? Yeah, 187. And I'll have a short explanation of that, and then we'll do our bill.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 187, as introduced, establishes a task force to make recommendations regarding the protection of privacy of students using education software. We are considering the Dash 3 amendments to this bill, which remove the establishment of the task force and establish the Oregon Student Information Protection Act, which prohibits operators of internet websites, online services, online applications, or mobile applications from knowingly engaging in specified activities with regard to services or applications for kindergarten through grade 12 purposes. Senate Bill 187 with the Dash 3 amendments has no revenue impact, and a minimal fiscal impact has been issued for the bill with the Dash 3 amendments.
And the Dash 3 amendments have a fair amount to them. So I think, is Aaron here? Aaron, if you want to come up, we can have an extra.
Sure.
And Cheryl? Also, there, a person from industry, Megan Schrader, is here. You can come on up to Megan, because I think you were part of the work group as well. And she's from TechNet. So,
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Attorney General in the Department of Justice. The Dash 3 amendments, as the chair referred, are a complete replacement of the bill, but they're consistent with the testimony you heard at the public hearing at that time. That was on the Dash 1 amendments. As a reminder, this bill puts sideboards around how educational technology providers can use student data. Basically, it's a prohibition against direct marketing. This is based on a bill that came out of California, the Student Online Personal Information Act, or SOPIPA. We loosely modeled the Oregon version off of that concept. Since the public hearing, we've had a lot of conversations with industry around taking a hard look at the definitions that came out of California, and I think we've accommodated most, though not all, of the requests that industry has made. Also, Senator Canope had a constituent who offered up Dash 2 amendments, and we consulted with them and were able to incorporate their concerns, I believe, in its entirety in the Dash 3s. So I have with me Cheryl Heemstra. She's really the technical person on this, so she can answer any more detailed questions.
Any questions of them? Okay. So, sure.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Megan Schrader. I'm with TechNet. It's a member-based organization representing some of the nation's leading companies in the fields of information technology, internet media, e-commerce, and others. But I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank the Attorney General's Office for working with us on Senate Bill 187. We want to make sure that the best bill possible comes out to strike the balance of protecting student data while also providing the best user and educational experience possible. We've come a long way in making some great strides in the bill. There's a couple of small outstanding issues, and we look forward to continuing to work with the AG's office on getting the best bill moving as possible.
Any other questions? Okay, so I will entertain a motion.
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the -3 amendments as presented.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the -3 amendments as presented. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? They are adopted. Senator Knope.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 187 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded, and that the bill be referred to Judiciary.
So as you heard, it minimals and all everything, so we don't really need to send it there. So Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 187 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the prior subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded, and that the bill be referred to Judiciary. Is there any discussion? Yes.
I'm assuming you guys will get it fixed before we hear it down there in Judish. I mean, you're still working, right?
Chair Roblin, Senator Cruz, we are still in conversations, okay. And the Chair of Judiciary knows the bill is coming.
Okay.
And I think there may be parts that they may never get to a total agreement on.
They may not, but
from my perspective as well, I think there are things that we really need to protect, and if there's no way to do that, but I'll leave that to you guys, so I agree.
Well, yeah, Senator Gelser and I will be dealing
exactly.
with it still.
So. You'll be down there. Is there any further discussion?
Does that mean we have to keep talking to Aaron?
Is there any objection?
We have to keep talking to Aaron.
It has been
occasionally, but not very often. Avoid it, so
thank you all for being here, and thank you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin.
Yep. So with that, we'll close our work session on Senate Bill 187, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 667. Is that the one? Which one?
Senator Hughes is 790.
Okay, we're going to move that. It's a public hearing. Can you wait a little while? We'll get through these. Senator Hansel. Okay. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 667. We'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 667 removes the sunset related to grants distributed to small school districts with one or more small high schools. This bill has no subsequent referral by prior reference. We are considering the -1 amendments at this time, which extend the sunset related to grants distributed to small school districts until July 1st, 2020. A fiscal impact has been issued for Senate Bill 667 as introduced and with the -1 amendments, and a revenue impact has been issued for both the bill as introduced and with the -1 amendments as well.
And it's not. And we are okay with both of them. Okay. So, Senator Knope?
Chair Roblin,
yes.
Yes.
Oh, you got
it. Did you want me to do it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I do.
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the -1 amendments as presented.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the -1 amendments as presented. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, I think this makes Beaverton a small school district. So thereby
then
getting unanimous
okay, right?
support on the committee. Yes.
Other discussion?
Sure. yes, it does say schools over 52,000 would qualify for this. After we had our hearing last week, some people came to me and some schools are saying, you know, there are at least there's one task force and other groups talking about changing the formula, the way we do things, having to do with ELL, ninth grade learning, and we still have this unresolved issue of using K through 12 money for college. So it might be more prudent and conservative to go to 5 years, which is 2020, which seems like a long time from now, instead of permanence. So I would support this.
Okay. Any other discussion? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I will not support this amendment because quite simply, if we're going to change things, we're going to change things whether there's a sunset or not, and chances are we could change it next year if we wanted to. And, you know, we've been playing this game for a while. I mean, this is such a small part of the budget anyway. I'd just as soon give these schools a higher level of certainty out in the future. And so for that reason, I will not support the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay.
Cool.
So much for you, Dan.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I will support the Dash 1 amendment. I think a 5-year extension is better than a 1-year extension. And last year we were going to do a 5-year extension. Well. So I appreciate the concerns that were raised, and I appreciate your objection. But
yes,
I'll support it. Around here, 5 years is a lifetime. 4 election cycles, or at least 2 election cycles.
Yeah, at least 2. Yeah. Any other discussion? Seeing none, I will do a roll call vote.
No.
Senator Byer?
Yes.
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator Hatch?
Yes.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Vice Chair Knope?
Aye.
And Chair Roland?
Aye. It passes. Who wants to carry this bill?
That was the amendment.
Oh, that was the amendment. Thank you. Thank you very much. You keep me on track.
Or do you want to?
So now you don't feel so bad about 100 years.
Good.
Okay. So, Senator Cano.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 667 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cano moves Senate Bill 667 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I'm fine with the bill.
Is there? is there any opposition? Oh, seeing none, it passes. Did you want to carry this?
No. We're going to we could co-carry if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Are you serious?
Well, we're the
okay. Sure, yeah. I would love to have you co-carry.
A warm moment on the floor.
Yeah,
that's right. Okay. Senator Cruz and Senator, anybody who wants to go first?
Senator Gelser will lead off, and I'll do a cleanup.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Well, you said that was okay.
No, it's fine.
We'll
okay.
close the work session on 667, and we will. We can. How many more do we have of those? Because we have some members that are waiting. Okay. We are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 790. So with that, Senator Hansel, you want to come forward, and you want to give a... And Dr. Andrew Clark, is that the other person that was coming up?
Yes, he's here as well, if you'd like.
Sure, have him come on out. And with that, we'll have a short explanation of the bill.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 790 requires the Department of Justice to encourage and support services, programs, and curricula to educate and inform students in grades 7 through 12 about domestic violence. This bill has no subsequent referral by prior reference. We are not considering amendments at this time. But we may consider an amendment in the future. This bill may have a fiscal impact. Statements have not yet been issued, and there's no revenue impact at this time.
Okay. With that, Senator Hansel, thanks for being here again.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, for the record, Bill Hansel, State Senator, District 29, Eastern Oregon. Senate Bill 790 comes to this committee from a meeting I had with several advocates and constituents last September. Some of them will testify later, including Dr. Clark. This is one of the three proposed domestic violence legislation that I've sponsored this session. According to statistics from the FBI in 2012, there were 11,766 women killed by their husbands or boyfriends. Although domestic violence is not a single gender issue, it predominantly occurs with the woman being the victim. This bill, Senate Bill 790, is an attempt to bring this number down by educating young people on the subject early on. Currently, in grades 7 through 12, there is required education on teen dating violence. Teen dating violence is where a pattern of behavior in which a person uses or threatens to use physical, mental, sexual, violence or emotional abuse to control another person who is in a dating relationship with that person, where one or both persons are 13 to 19 years old. I believe we have a need and opportunity to educate students on the importance of domestic violence. Domestic violence, for the use in this bill, is when there is abuse between family members when they are attempting to cause, either intentionally or recklessly, the bodily injury of a family member, or by placing another in constant fear of injury. The thought behind this bill is, if a student is being taught in schools about the dangers and problems of teen dating violence, but then they go home and experience domestic violence, they should learn why this is also unacceptable. This bill would require school districts to adopt policies to incorporate age-appropriate education regarding domestic violence into the classrooms at some point in grades 7 through 12, just as they do now with teen dating violence. Another aspect of this bill is to authorize the Department of Human Services to make grants to and enter into contracts with nonprofit, private organizations, or public agencies for programs and projects designed to prevent, identify, and treat domestic violence. This is also currently being done for the teen dating violence and would simply expand this to include domestic violence. I believe the education of students about domestic violence will be able to help reduce this problem that we have. Also, I do not believe this is too much of an ask on our teachers in the classrooms, as they are currently teaching teen dating violence. To add domestic violence makes sense to me. Thank you very much, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
So any questions for Senator Hensel? Thank you, and thank you for the bill. Doctor.
Mr. Chairman, members, greetings to you. I come from Eastern Oregon. My name is Andrew Clark, and I live in Pendleton. Can I refer you to this packet that you have been given, please? I would like to discuss several things in it. This document is within the last 2 weeks from Joe Biden, our vice president, who states, public health, domestic violence is a public health epidemic that requires urgent attention in it. We have to keep making the case even stronger for prevention, which is the bailiwick of education in my view here, and intervention. This is a national problem. The next document is from the Centers for Disease Control, CDC. Mr. Chairman, you have a copy of the complete report, but if you will open that to the second and third pages, please, we'll find statistics from each state in the United States. In terms of domestic violence, the state with the worst record is Alaska, and Oregon is the next worst record in the national picture. We are the second worst state for domestic violence against women in the nation. This is something, as Oregonians, that we should all look at, not with pride, but rather with shame, and we really need to do better to deal with this issue. It's sexual violence and victimization among women. The CDC is a responsible organization, and I think we need to take it seriously. The third document is a domestic violence shield law for Oregon. I would like to go through these visuals very quickly with you to indicate the global aspect of what we think needs to be done. The first, page number one on the overleaf of the cover, is covered in this packet. Page two is what Senator Hansel has referred to. During the terror attacks, Afghan and Iraqi wars, there were 9,561 military personnel killed. In that same time period, 11,766 women were killed by domestic violence. This is a shocking statistic, I think. The page three deals with some facts about Oregon and also on the national scene. And page four is comparative deaths of those who are enforcing the domestic violence laws and those who are killed in Oregon by domestic violence, a comparative graph. Page five indicates the components of what leads to lethal action in terms of domestic violence. Strangulation, loss of jobs, stress factors, and so on, they are listed there for you, and these are all components of the domestic violence situation that in one way or another need dealing with. The consequences for the victim of lethal action, that is a woman who kills her abuser, if she does not defend herself, in terms especially of strangulation, she dies. If she kills her abuser in self-defense, one of two things, the abuser dies, she goes to jail for 10 or 12 years. This is a very inequitable situation that needs to be dealt with in Oregon statute, because there are a number of women who are incarcerated who are in fact the victims, not the perpetrators. We need to deal with this. The predictors of lethality on page 7 are essentially laid out, and as the building blocks of domestic violence on page 8, terminating in strangulation as the most serious predictor of lethality. Those are simply informational type things for what leads up to lethality in terms of domestic violence. The issue of imminent threat or imminent danger is portrayed in the illustration on page 9, in which the victim, living in a constant environment of imminent threat of death, is part of domestic violence that we need to deal with. The next two pages deal with strangulation, which are not in the purview of this committee. It's just for information. Page 14, why doesn't she just leave, is informational, but on page 15 is a graph showing the escalation of abuse from the initial verbal abuse, threats, and the first hit. These are points of intervention that are educational. From there on out, it's interventional. But I think what the education committee is responsible for is providing information, especially to young women, but to young men as well, in either junior high school and high school, so that they recognize what domestic violence is, they recognize potential threats, they are able to not be involved initially or know how to escape if they are experiencing it. That would be part of the educational program. The rest of this booklet is generic in scope. But on page 20, the first thing for a domestic violence shield law is to require domestic violence education of all secondary students. And that, I think, also should apply early on to, as Senator Hansel mentioned, age-appropriate education, not only of secondary school, but of younger students as well. On page 22, the school is where domestic violence prevention can start. Our concern is that we have a very deleterious record in Oregon, but to begin the prevention of domestic violence, we can do that right now through the schools. That is the basic component of reducing violence in the future. We then pick up interventions for abuse when it happens, secondarily. So statewide education and intervention is a critical issue. On page 25, we have mentioned in the right-hand column education of youth and other Oregon citizens on the dynamics of abuse is a critical issue so that we can bring down the level of violence in Oregon. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to come.
Any questions for Dr. Clark? Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Excuse me, may I just mention,
sure,
in this document, we deal with training as well. This document is 4 pages that outlines the global aspect of domestic violence in Oregon and what we suggest can be done about it.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. So now we have Louise Benchcourt, Lisa Swart, and Lori Satinsville.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for having us come in today and talk about our bill. We're pleased that it's being heard. I'm Louise Bouchard. I am the director of Voices Set Free. It's a nonprofit organization located in Hillsboro, Oregon. And I am a licensed clinical social worker. I worked for 17 years in the Department of Community Corrections in Hillsboro, Oregon, where I was supervising mental health service providers, mental health students so that they could get their degrees, on and on in terms of what we were doing with justice-involved families. So having the opportunity to talk about this bill today is a privilege for me. Senate Bill 790 seeks to get ahead of the problem of family violence. It provides a new tool for Oregon youth to learn about how they can prevent domestic violence in their adult lives. It is a well-accepted fact that family violence is an intergenerational problem where children growing up in families see violence and repeat these behaviors. And repeat these behaviors in their adult lives. My recommendation is ways to grasp, my way of recommending to grasp the potential of this proposal is to consider the well-established metaphor in the medical field, health field, of upstream and downstream. The difference was demonstrated in the number of heart attacks that happened in the population. But it was only after prevention practices were added to the sophisticated rescue treatment of those heart attacks that the number of people dying of heart attacks plummeted. Belatedly, the medical system realized that they needed to look further upstream to see why these folks were falling into the heart attack field river. Now almost everyone knows that the low-fat diet, exercise, stress reduction, and of course non-smoking and other ailments were the causes and could be helped in the elimination of heart attacks. So I believe a strong parallel exists in the approach to domestic violence. The criminal justice system in this day and age is the organization with sophisticated arrest procedures and complex incarceration protocols. Bill 790 adds upstream prevention by providing education to youth about the causes of family violence. It's a vital part of their education. What do we learn about family violence when we look upstream? Perpetrators and victims tell us, and I have worked with a number of people in these families, that over and over again, the seeds of violence were sown in their own childhoods. In other words, they experienced it firsthand. The violence cycle infects the children caught between these parents. We need to intervene so our youth aren't condemned to relive this same violence. Upstream thinking in healthcare led us to prevention solutions that dramatically reduce the number of heart attacks. Upstream thinking in the criminal justice system can lead us to violent prevention solutions, and this cost will less than building more prisons to hold the dramatic escalation of incarceration. And I can say that the facts are very staggering. With 5% of the world's population, we have 25% of the people incarcerated, felons. 7 million, or 1 in 10 children in the United States, has a parent under the criminal justice system, either as a probationer, as someone in prison, probation, parole. That's unbelievable numbers. Right now in my own county where I work, there are over 10,000 children in our county alone who have a criminal justice parent. And that's from the Portland State Research Department. 23% of our Oregon children are in poverty, living in poverty. And the women's prison population has escalated 86% over the past decade, something we need to really, really address. Crime has not gone in that same direction. A woman or child is killed roughly every 10 days, that's in our report here, in Oregon by a batterer. Very often children whose mothers are incarcerated are placed in foster care, very often. More children enter foster care in Oregon than in nearly any other state, another huge dramatic statement. We have 1.9%, the national is 0.9%, 1.5%, excuse me. Okay, more on our upstream approach. Adverse childhood experiences, and it's called ACE, is the term used as a landmark study research project funded by Kaiser Health and the Communicable Disease Center, identifying 10 factors that predict social health, emotional problems in childhood that will lead up to the exposed in the adulthood. Our original study of 17,000 persons published in 98 has been confirmed in 57 studies thereafter. That's pretty incredible confirmation. And there are some programs that are looking at upstream for the justice system. And I have visited some of those in my work in Washington County. Oregon can learn from the prevention models that are used in San Francisco and Seattle that incorporate prevention services into the criminal justice system. Senate Bill 790 places the responsibility for domestic violence education within the Department of Human Services. That is good, good. In Oregon, is Oregon ready to invest significantly more resources in the future of youth right away? Oregon has the opportunity to make a dramatic step towards prevention by providing domestic violence education to all our youth, not just those we happen to have in Washington County. And our first step is passing this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity. I'm Lisa Swart, and I'm the Director of Crisis Services at AODVC and SASHA, which is Sexual Assault Help and Support for Americans Abroad. I want to be brief here, but the Oregon Bureau of Labor has estimated that there are $50 million in Oregon every year that are lost due to non-productivity because of domestic violence victims being in the hospital or having crises that they have to deal with. Another $50 million is spent in direct services. So that's $100 million a year that domestic violence is costing our state. Vice President Biden has declared that domestic violence is an epidemic. And the best way to deal with epidemics is sort of to vaccinate and prevent it in the future. So I consider education a form of vaccination so that eventually, years down the road, there will be a much greater level of prevention because everybody will be understanding. Some of our clients don't even realize that what they are doing is domestic abuse. Some of them don't realize that what they are experiencing is domestic abuse because it's what they're used to. It's they're normal, and they don't understand. So educating students early on as to what constitutes abuse and also better ways to handle conflict resolution that don't involve, you know, controlling someone through violence is a really important thing to start on a statewide level because mm-hmm. being the second from the bottom is not where Oregon wants to remain. Mm-hmm. So planting these seeds now will eventually create an orchard of health and progressive thinking. And so I'm urging you to support this. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these two?
Yeah, two
questions. Nope, thank you.
Okay.
Is there anyone else who didn't sign up who would like to speak to this bill? Okay. We did get one request to consider an amendment for this bill, and I'll talk to Senator Hansel about it. And it just was a simple one that said, would you consider an amendment that would require schools to publicly post the National Domestic Abuse Hotline phone number? So we do a lot of posting in schools. It's a possibility that that's something that Senator Hansel would like as well. So we'll have that conversation before the bill comes back. So with that, we will. Oh, no, Lori doesn't want to come. She was on the wrong bill. This bill? Come on up. Changed her nod in the middle of
this. Chair and members of the committee, Lori Satins, bill for the Oregon School Boards Association. Sorry, I'm late to the party.
I needed a wingman because my wingwoman left to go testify somewhere else.
Okay.
I just wanted to bring to the attention, I'm here today to just be a resource. I've got our OSBA policies on bullying, harassing, teen dating violence. All of those policies are now on OLIS to show you what is out there already. And I asked Eli from the department to come and help me a little bit with what kind of curriculum is already being taught and how this can help with what you're looking for in this bill. I'm going to go to Eli, and then maybe Nikki will be back in time to talk about the teen dating violence and how they already touch on domestic violence in their curriculum.
Good afternoon. My name is Eli Sanders, sexual health and school health specialist for the Oregon Department of Education. Thank you, Chair, and the rest of the committee. I came prepared to provide information on a subsequent bill coming up, Senate Bill 856, which is related under the violence prevention umbrella. And some of that information will be pertinent to the information, I think, to this bill, around what is already existing in both statute and benchmarks and standards around violence prevention. And so, you know, in lieu of that, there's a significant amount of guidance in the benchmarks already around violence prevention as and the healthy teen relationships. ODE is officially neutral on these bills and is happy to help and look at ways to increase ways to provide prevention education to K-12. So I'm available for questions as well.
So I guess my question would be, do you see it as a major job or hardship to put some information of this kind directly about domestic violence as opposed to the sexual assault, the other kinds of things that we have there? I know it sounds like there's some of it already, but to put that in, we're not asking for a course, we're just asking for information. Do you see that as a major hardship, or do you see anything that isn't being done that could be added to it that would add to the conversations they're having at the schools now?
Thank you, Chair. Do I see anything? I don't think it would be a hardship or burden necessarily to add language that's aligned to what's already there, as well as look in and evaluate what's there to make sure that it's you know, current and up to quality standards and best practices that are active. You know, healthy relationship promotion is violence prevention, and so whether it's teen relationships or other relationships, I think it's all included.
Mr. Chair, I'd also want to comment. I had a call from a district out in John Day who was needing some help with some sex ed curriculum, and from abstinence to violence, and it was on the Department of Human Services website because I wasn't quite understanding what the question was being asked of me, and I ran across more information on the Department of Human Services site with curriculum, age appropriate, and I'm blanking on future choice.
My future, my choice?
That's it. And so there's other ways that districts are actually bringing in curriculum as well.
There may not be much. Yes, Senator Cruz.
I think the point you're about to make, Ms. Chair, is before we do more, we ought to find out what is. So, and the question I was going to ask was the age appropriateness, because that kind of speaks to the core of this. The domestic violence is more of an age appropriate thing than dating violence, which most first graders aren't dating, I don't think. So,
exactly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz.
Well, I didn't. Okay.
I want to refer you to the Department of Ed's the K-3, the benchmark, which explaining the difference between appropriate touch and inappropriate touch, identifying parents and other trusted adults, demonstrate how to clearly say no. Some of those age-appropriate kind of things right. that are in your materials. That okay. might be a great place to start as you look to figure out what you want to do with the bill.
Yeah, that is kind of my question. My only other one was the fact that I think one of the things that was mentioned by one of the previous testimony is something that's always frustrated me as a high school person, and that is I get it. I don't want my boyfriend to hit me. I understand that's all right. But when they go home, they've lived with the mom being beaten and whatever. That's different. They don't compute the same. I mean, it is really weird, but this is where I live, and I understand what's normal here. This is what the school is telling me is what's normal for me in the future. Okay. So they don't realize that they're being traumatized a lot of times at the home. And I think sometimes we need to be very specific with kids at different levels about the kinds of things that are appropriate and not appropriate.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's also the fact that what they've grown up with is often what they're attracted to.
Oh, that really happens. I agree
okay,
with that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Senator Roblin and committee, if I can comment
sure,
on that
please.
Real quick. And I think that what you highlighted there is the importance of both comprehensive sexual health education as well as the overall health standards and benchmarks and really being able to look at and working with students to identify what is healthy and unhealthy and identifying goals. And the relationship, and I think both within the family, K through fifth grade is really child abuse and sexual abuse prevention.
Okay.
Middle school and high school is where the relationship and
okay.
starts. So
okay.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Did you want your other person to speak?
I think we're good unless you want to hear
no,
more about
good.
Teen dating violence and the work
I think
we've
we're okay.
okay.
Thanks.
We've probably seen Nikki enough for one day. So.
Thank you. Thank you both. So we're going to close our public meeting on Senate Bill 790. Do the work sessions? When he comes back. So which one are we going to do? This one? He could do this.
759.
We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 759. And with that, we'll have a short explanation. And who do we want to come up first? Is Rep. Springer and
Sam Gelser Bill.
Gelser.
Yeah. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, Senate Bill 759 requires four-year post-secondary institutions that enroll students who receive Oregon Opportunity Grants to adopt written protocol to ensure that students who report sexual assault receive services and assistance.
Okay. You want to do it from
there?
Can
we just do it from here?
Sure.
So this is a...
Just identify yourself as a witness.
Do I need to do that, really?
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who are you?
Hi, my name's Sarah Gelser.
Hi, Sarah.
I'm the state senator from Senate District 8. This bill comes to you from Senator Knope and Senator Cruz, and a whole lot of you, actually. So this bill, Senate Bill 759, is intended to address the issue around campus sexual assault. The bill still needs a little bit of work to be ready for prime time. The goal of the bill is to ensure that when a sexual assault is reported that's taking place on campus, that that individual is able to do so in a confidential way and that they receive written notice in a format that is easily understandable about what the rights of that individual are. That would include access to resources that might be available to support that person and the difference between a campus disciplinary procedure and a criminal procedure. The bill does not require that campuses report every sexual assault that's reported to them to law enforcement. That was very important to the advocates. That decision really needs to be left up to the victim to determine whether or not they want to move forward with that. There have been some concerns raised by the nonprofit agencies that support survivors about the fiscal impact of having a formal memorandum of understanding between the university systems and the organizations off campus. We're working on that. One way to get around that might be in that written notice to have the telephone numbers of the local organizations, and then people would enter into those services in the same way that any member of the community might do that. But this is an important bill. I think we will have it ready to work in the very near future, and it's an important companion to a bill that will be coming out of the House soon that extends privilege to certified sexual assault advocates. And that means when an individual goes and they seek that initial information, that they are able to talk to somebody that can really walk them through their options, what they need to do. Do they need to go to the hospital? How are they feeling? Without being worried that everything that they've said at that moment that they're in crisis is going to come back and be used against them later in some way that they don't intend. The bill that's before you is the product of a lot of work that was done in the interim with the former governor's office. Elizabeth Muse in the governor's office in particular has done an extraordinary amount of work on this, the Oregon Student Association, and a whole lot of other folks who will tell you more about it. But we will continue working, and your input would be much appreciated so that we can cause as little work for legislative council as possible by minimizing the number of amendment requests that go in.
Thank you very much. Any questions of Senator Gelster?
No, Mr. Chair, just a comment, because I signed on the bill basically to have a safe haven to go to without fear of I'm going to be on the front page of the paper. You know, is I think incredibly critical, and I think this is an important step, so the victims do know they have a safe place to go. If they want to go beyond that, that would clearly be their choice. But to be able to know that there's somebody they can talk to, without fear of the entire campus knowing about it, I think is hugely important.
Well, and the one thing that I would add, that piece about providing the notification, the way that it's written in the bill, it says any institution that receives Oregon Opportunity Grant, that's the way that we create that hook to pull everybody in. The intention is not to yank all of the opportunity grant away from an institution if they failed to provide it. Our expectation would be we've created a law. It would be the obligation of the institution to provide that notice. I believe there would be a number of remedies that a victim might have if they were not provided that notice. I think there have been a lot of stories in the press recently. I see Brenda Tracy is in the room about the unfortunate outcomes unfortunate outcomes of not allowing victims to have access to the information they need to pursue a criminal prosecution, preserve evidence, and to know what options are available to them, and that's so important for people to be able to get the justice they deserve. Hi, Representative Springer.
And she was talking, and then Senator Cruz added on because I knew you would be here.
Well, come on down and tell what it really does, Senator.
You look much better.
Yeah, you look great there.
Oh, well, thank you. For the record, I'm Sherry Springer, State Representative, House District 17. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to come here and talk to you about Senate Bill 759, product of effort that primarily Senator Gelser headed up, quite frankly, and several have worked on. And the particulars of this bill, I know I'm pretty confident that she has talked to you about the protocol and what the bill actually does. I just want to lend my voice to say this is an issue, sexual assaults on college campuses, that frankly I'd never given a lot of thought to before, given the complexities of the reporting. And we've really not served our students well on college campuses and made it very difficult for them. And I've learned a great deal since I started on this work, and appreciate everybody that has rolled up their sleeves and worked on it. And I must say, it's kind of hit close to home this time as we send our son, not daughter, to a college campus. And we hope we've done our best, and we hope we've made the impact we want. We think that we have. But I want him going to a place, and I don't care if we're talking our daughters or our sons, I want him going to a place knowing there is absolutely no tolerance to violate another person. And putting some of these protocols, some of these statutes in place, some of these methods really for reporting, that's what we're talking about, sends a clear message. Instead of something occurring on a campus and the victim now is victimized again because they don't know what they should do and don't have a safe place and there aren't resources available for them, this will change the conversation. This is going to change the conversation. And I'm excited about this. If you have any questions, I'll certainly answer them. I think Senator Gelser here is the expert on this piece. But thanks for having this hearing. I strongly encourage you to support this legislation.
Thank you. Any questions, sir? Okay. Thank you, Sherry, for
being
here.
Thank you.
With that, Brenda Tracy and Nikki Terzia. I think I got the. Oh, and we've also got, we'll get them next.
Ms. Julie.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'm Nikki Terzieff. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. We are a statewide nonprofit that delivers technical assistance, marshals foundation dollars, provides advocacy, legislative advocacy as well, for the 50-plus nonprofit emergency shelters and domestic violence and victim services programs around the state in each of your districts and also now including on tribal lands. And one of the great things about this bill, one of the things we really appreciate is the companionship that it gives to an additional bill that was referenced previously by Senator Gelser. Together, these two have the opportunity to really, I think, change the face and change the future of violence, in particular when it comes to campus sexual assault. We have enjoyed a close working relationship with the Oregon Student Association and others around the table on this particular piece of legislation. And while we do Senator Gelser have some concerns about mandated MOUs, memorandums of understanding between our nonprofit victim service programs and a university, I do think that we'd be very happy to talk about a concept where you can find a must seek out and give the programs the opportunity to say, you know, we're swamped right now, or, well, that's 40 miles away. Let's see what else we can do. Give us some time. Or, hey, let me refer you to this new program that's just opened up in the community over here. So not mandating the MOU itself, but mandating that conversation. I think that's the first step, ensuring that the door is open for that discussion to occur, and I think that's going to make a big difference in the first bite at that apple is going to be a great one. I also think as we start talking about the opportunity grant fund, if there is some way to look at other funds to incentivize universities to engage in this conversation, if there is a way that we can say, you know, you've got a panel of folks that are advocates, professional advocates like the ones that I represent at emergency, who work at emergency shelters and programs, and students and an administrator, just a panel of folks to say, these are the criteria we want to see you at the universities begin to implement, and working together with the universities and working together with Title IX coordinators so that we know that we're not confusing all of those reporting requirements, and just ensuring that as the conversation moves along, we've got some real skilled and experienced in perhaps both good and unfortunate ways informing the conversation of how we get to incentivize the universities to help folks, brave folks like Ms. Tracy.
Okay. Hi, my name is Brenda Tracy, and I'm a rape survivor. In 1998, I was gang raped by four men. Two of them were Oregon State University College football players. And I started the process, the criminal process, and there was a huge backlash after I had done my rape kit, reported to the police, and then the players were arrested. So through a series of events that transpired, death threats against myself, my children, the media attention, and everything that went along with that, I ended up backing down and dropping charges. At that point, I decided to go to the university and report. I felt like I wanted something done, and I was not able to withstand the criminal process, which I was also misled about that, but that's a different bill and story. Mm-hmm. But so I went to the university. I reported what had happened to me to a sexual assault coordinator at the time. She asked me, you know, what would you like to see happen? We discussed education, we discussed expelling the students, we discussed academic probation, we discussed many, many things. And my intent at that point by reporting was to not only have the situation addressed, but to help change things on campus. I didn't want anyone else to go through what I had gone through. And being in my early 20s, being young and being naive, I trusted the people at the university to do the right thing. I thought that they had my best interest at heart. And I had this discussion with this counselor and I left. And I did not follow up. I felt that I just trusted that they would do the right thing. Later in the paper, I found out that my attackers were given a one-game suspension for the football season that year. which was hurtful to me. I thought that, you know, gang rape and sodomy is not equate to a one game football suspension. I didn't know what else the school did. I was so traumatized that I really just wanted to forget that the whole thing happened. And like many survivors, you think that you can just put it away in a box, put it in the closet, and be like, okay, we're done with that. And I'll just move on with my life. And the fact of the matter is that you don't. Eventually, you have to deal with what's in that box. And that is what I started to do several months ago. I opened up that box. Sorry. So, when I came out with my story recently in the Oregonian, John Canzano did an amazing job with my story in telling what happened to me. The president of Oregon State University launched an immediate investigation, and I was given the results of that investigation, and the big conclusion to the investigation was that my rapists were given a one-game suspension. They were given 25 hours of community service, and they were put on conduct probation, and they were given some sort of an education class. Now, I find that appalling, and I find that horrible, and I find it unfair. I think that the investigation that was held by John Canzano showed very clearly, even by the statements of the people back then, that the school put the athletics before me. They put athletics and money, gift giving, student enrollment, the school's reputation before my life and what happened to me. And I think that, yes, my story happened almost 17 years ago, but we still see it today in the news. We still see universities placing reputation and money before the lives of students. We know that colleges are not doing what they need to be doing with sexual assault because the number is 1 in 5. That's the proof right there. We know that colleges are failing our students because otherwise the number wouldn't be 1 in 5. Rape and sexual violence has become a part of a woman's college experience. And that is disgusting and appalling to me. I have sons, like Ms. Springer said earlier, and I want them to go to college. I want them to have a good experience. I want them to become educated. But I don't want sexual violence and be raped to be a part of their college experience. I wouldn't want to have to sit my daughter down and say, honey, I'm going to send you to college, but you know what? There's a huge chance that you're going to be raped. And we need to probably prepare for that, because most likely you will be. You will endure some sort of sexual violence. That's horrible to me. That's the conversation we should be having with our students going to college. So these bills that Senator Gelser has brought before you, it's a package deal. It's so important. We have to start protecting our students. They are going to college to try to better themselves. It's an accomplishment to get into college. It's an accomplishment to receive a degree. We have to protect them. I was fortunate enough to be able to come away from my rape and go to school. I'm a registered nurse. I have a bachelor's degree. I have a master's in business and healthcare management. And I've dedicated my life to helping other people because someone helped me. But not all college students are that way. If you look at the statistics, we are losing bright young women that are dropping out of school, not finishing their degrees. We're losing too many women. And this happens to men too, and they don't talk about it, even less than what women talk about it. So privilege, confidential conversations, support, resources, giving students resources and in clear terms that they can understand, that's important. This is a life-altering thing that happens to you. If you don't have information that you can clearly understand to make an informed decision, then you can't really make a good decision. And I was not afforded that opportunity. I was not able to make an informed decision. People made decisions for me based on what was best for them. Nobody did what was best for me. And I'm asking that we implement laws that we have to do the right thing. Because as it is now, we left the universities to make those decisions and make the right decisions, and they're not. And we need to hold them accountable. And we need to tell our college students that we care about you. We want you to go to we want you to get an education. We want you to go to college. We want you to do well. And we're going to protect you. And we're going to take care of you. And God forbid, if something happens to you, we're gonna help you and try to make it right. So I would ask that you please pass this bill. It's very important. Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you have questions for me, I would be more than happy to answer any questions. You cannot offend me. So don't
thank
worry
you,
about being appropriate or anything.
So thanks, and also thanks for being brave enough to do this, because it's a very difficult thing. And having been a principal in a school where we've had to deal with this a few times, and I have some friends that have had to endure what you've endured, and difficult conversations, and
it is really
life-changing experience for people.
It is, but I'm proud to speak on behalf of thousands of survivors, and I hope.
Senator Cruz.
I think you've been before virtually every committee I sit on now.
Yes, I've seen you frequently.
I know, and we've chatted in my office too. And
yes.
First off, I want to thank you for what you're doing, and I hope that by the end of this, you're gonna find the closure you're looking for.
Yes.
And it is, you know, Jameis Winston, Florida State. I mean, same thing. You know, there's pecking orders at universities, and the universities need to be held accountable for their quote unquote average students, not just the superstars. So
absolutely, everyone deserves protection under the law. I mean, that's why we have laws.
Yeah.
Everyone. It's no respecter of persons, or shouldn't be.
We're going to find you closure in this, okay?
And to keep telling everybody, this is my therapy.
Yeah, I know.
Standing
up
for others. This is how I'm getting through this. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gelser.
Thank you. It occurred to me, I was having the same thought. Gosh, you've got to be tired. You're in a committee every day. And you referenced a lot of different bills that you're talking about. And I think the key message in that is our justice system, our culture still isn't set up to meet the needs of victims of rape and domestic violence. And the fact that you need to spend so much time going to so many different kinds of committees to talk about so many different bills that do so many different things demonstrates that while we have a lot of work to do, that when we do that work, maybe things can get better, because we're not just changing the laws, we're changing the culture and the expectation that people have.
Absolutely.
And that expectation that you can sit in a very public place and say, these are the things that happened to me, and do that in the way that you have, with courage, and to know that there's no shame in doing that. And that is the most important change that we have to make, because that's the one that precedes being able to make the changes in the law and the changes in the culture so that people behave in different ways towards each
Absolutely.
Other.
Absolutely. And I also support the domestic violence bill to educate children. I would have spoke on that one if I had known it was happening. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both.
I think she's probably going to run for office at some
point. That's what
I didn't pay him.
We had
so
that
Julie Karen
yesterday.
And Emma Calloway.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and committee. I'm speaking on behalf of all the public universities in Oregon's Title IX coordinators. My name is Julie Karen, and I am PSU's Title IX coordinator. You'll be handed a fact sheet for each public university about what is being done on our campuses regarding sexual assault, as well as a letter to the committee on how we support legislation to help advance prevention and response to sexual assault. Title IX coordinators have the responsibility of response and prevention of interpersonal violence sexual assault. Title IX is a federal law. It basically says that no educational institution will discriminate on the basis of gender. The Office of Civil Rights for the Department of Education has interpreted that to include sexual harassment, and sexual harassment includes sexual assault, A lot of people think of Title IX to be concerned with equity in athletics, but it really involves, and it has been involved lately and pertinently since April of 2011, of addressing sexual assault on college campuses. And that's where the title, Title IX coordinator, comes from. So the Title IX coordinators understand the urgency in addressing interpersonal violence on our campuses, and we are deeply committed to preventing sexual assault and misconduct on our campuses. Studies show that interpersonal violence impacts students severely. It impacts their mental health, it impacts their academic progress, as well as has been mentioned earlier, a number of students will end up dropping out of school from being sexually harassed, stalked, sexually assaulted, or any other form of interpersonal violence. The universities are committed to helping to prevent sexual assault and other interpersonal violences from occurring on their campuses, on our campuses. There's a number of things that are happening on campuses that are very exciting. We desire all of our students to have access to their education. The universities provide wraparound services for students who have experienced sexual assault or any other form of interpersonal violence. That includes having student health counseling services where students can go for privileged confidential services. 5 out of the 7 public universities, and I'm not sure about the other two, but I know for sure that 5 out of the other 7 are either providing confidential services through their advocates or in the process of. PSU will be announcing on April 15th that their interpersonal violence advocates will become confidential. We are going forward with this without even having the privilege, the statutory privilege, because we know of the importance of it. We urge that the House bill, House bill 3476 is also passed, so there can be the additional privilege. What it means to have a confidential advocate that's not privileged is that the advocate will not be required to report any information to the university officials, such as the Title IX coordinator or the conduct or law enforcement. It will become victim-centered, so students can come to the advocate, learn about their reporting options, and be able to decide for themselves how they would like to move forward with the incident that they have experienced. This will allow them to get the services that are needed. What I mean by wraparound services is that students, when they come to talk to an advocate, the advocate will help them with changes in housing, either changing the victim or the perpetrator's housing, changes in their classrooms, support with academics, such as getting extensions on papers or possibly incompletes in classes so they can make up the work at a later date, and assistance with their finances. The university is committed to providing these services to students to make sure that they are appropriately accommodated. Under Title IX, as well as the Campus Sexual Violence Elimination Act, which is part of the Clery Act, these federal laws are requiring universities to take specific processes and to develop prevention programs to eliminate interpersonal violence. The Clery Act requires all universities to report on their website the statistics of crimes, and that includes crimes of sexual assault and stalking, so all public can see what crimes have been reported. They're not necessarily ones that have been had findings or convictions, but anything that's been reported to the university. We're required to inform students of our policies, code of conducts, resources, and reporting options. All of the universities are doing that currently by either in-person trainings or student modules, and this is done before they come to campus and during the time they're at campus. Additionally, when a student has experienced a sexual assault, faculty and staff have a handout that they will give to students to let them know what their resources are and where to get help, as well as their reporting options. That's one form, and I'll provide a copy of that to the committee after today. The other thing that when a student goes to the Women's Resource Center to report an incident, of interpersonal violence, then the students are given a specific handout showing what their options are, what services are available to them. And not only Portland State does this, but all of the universities are providing this information to students to make sure that they know their rights and that they know how to get the services that they need. Additionally, when a student does decide to report, or if the information comes to somebody who isn't confidential, which means that the information, then there may need to be an investigation. Investigations are done in an equitable and victim-centered manner. Some universities do their investigations by sole investigators, others do them by conduct committee. All the investigators and conduct committees are trained on appropriate intervention with victims and others so that it is trauma victim centered. We also, in addition to being able to report to the Dean of Student Life and myself as a Title IX coordinator, we do have anonymous reporting available. The anonymous reporting is available for statistical purposes so that it can be reported with our Cleary reports, and also for me as the Title IX coordinator to review it to see if there are any systemic issues on campus that need to be addressed. And our services, we look into and we support students whether or not the incident has occurred on or off campus. What we're concerned about is our well-being of our students. Many times that even if an incident occurred off campus, it impacts our students' education, and we want to make sure that they have the appropriate access to their education, and these incidents will not deter them. And in regard to prevention programs, sometimes it's difficult with the resources that are available, but all of the universities have and are developing additional prevention programs. The prevention programs, there's one part that's called primary prevention, and that's helping to change the norms so that males and females can understand what healthy relationships are, what true consent is. There's also some drug and alcohol training, as well as bystander intervention training, which is intervening when somebody sees that something has occurred. So universities are committed to providing training and prevention to our students to make sure that our campuses are safe. The Title IX Coordinator Work Group would like to see this legislative session pass House Bill 3476 to provide the statutory privilege. We find it extremely important for victims to be able to go to a confidential advocate, whether it's a community-based advocate or whether it's an on-campus advocate, and have the complete confidentiality. They will have a semi-confidentiality through our services we're providing, which the Office of Civil Rights and the Federal Department of Justice has authorized universities to do. However, without the complete privilege, there is always the risk that the advocates could be subpoenaed to speak about an incident. Additionally, we would encourage the committee to create some state funding, and that state funding could be to help benefit the universities in providing additional prevention programming, as well as to assist with the community-based organization so that they have the appropriate resources. The Title IX coordinators have been working closely with the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force, and we think that a state grant funding would be an appropriate place within the AG's task force for them to be able to administer, and universities and community-based organizations could apply for the necessary funds in order to advance their programs that they're having on their campuses. I'm happy to answer any questions. I am obviously more aware of all of the Portland State services that are being provided. You have been provided with an outline of the other universities' programs, but I am aware of some of their programs, but I can't speak specifically to all of their services.
Okay, Emma, we'll do first, then we'll have questions.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Student Association. And about a year ago, we surveyed about 30,000 students across the state at 20 campuses, one piece of paper at a time, because that's the most efficient way to do that. And we found that sexual assault response and prevention is one of the top issues on all campuses across all demographics. So we absolutely went out and talked to as many of our 120,000 members as possible in order to address this issue. Today we have students to share their stories about why we need services to be paired with new accountability measures. On campus, education can prevent sexual assault, and the services we're requesting will help keep survivors in school, which is our number one goal. I'd also like to share with you that I'm a person that was that could have been impacted positively by a bill like this. I know what it feels like to be physically overpowered, to have my choices taken away, and to then to have no place to turn in college because I didn't want to report these acts from a person that I knew. Confidential on-campus counseling, clearly posted resources and options for me would have made all the difference in my academic success. It would have meant the world to me to know that I didn't have to go through criminal proceedings to receive confidential counseling and support. And additionally, while this was happening in my own life, I was also the resident assistant in college for 45 students living in my hall, and three of my students were sexually assaulted in a single term. I knew our counseling services were not equipped to take on complicated cases that needed long-term support. At the time, the school I was working for was only able to provide counseling for about 10 weeks. And my institution would have benefited from having a memorandum of understanding that was robust enough to be able to handle cases like this with outside organizations and nonprofits who would have been and had the expertise necessary to support these students and also myself. This bill isn't about demonizing institutions, and that's important to us at the Oregon Student Association, but this bill is about giving students a choice and a set of resources to be successful. So on behalf of the 120,000 members that I represent and also myself, we're asking you to vote yes on this bill today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thanks. Seth Joyce and Lena DeMorlis. Either
one. I'll go first. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Seth Joyce. I'm a student at Lane Community College. I'm here to urge your support of Senate Bill 759. As a survivor, I am very passionate about what this bill could mean to hundreds, maybe thousands of students that experience sexual and physical assault on campuses across Oregon. My story of survival happened at a young age, and I'm still constantly dealing with that trauma. I cannot imagine going through this as a college student. As a college student, the pressure of adulthood and taking on payments and time and money for a college education you may or may not even use is enough stress. I'm here today with a testimony from a fellow student at Lane, someone who needed this bill. Here is their story. It is a really sad set of statistics and accounts that bring us here today. However, today comes with the opportunity to pass this bill and make a significant difference in the lives of our students and advocates. Senate Bill 759 will have an immediate impact, and it would be foolish to question the advancements that will come by partnering these services, which have already proven results, with the power of education. We need this now. We've waited long enough. We need that help in the field, on campus, so that we can actually start achieving steps towards prevention. I am terrified for my daughter and my sisters because this happens to so many of us every day. These stories don't surprise us, though they will always horrify us. This bill would ensure the support to the safety of our communities and the healing of our injured but resilient students who pursue their educational dreams even through the trauma of rape or assault. After my soldier came back from Iraq, he took out his trauma on me through rape and brutal use of weapons and scare tactics. While desperately trying to get help during the most dangerous time in my life, I found a locked door and a closed sign. I was too far from the resources to access them. I had two small children, limited time, and no money. I'd spent what I had on a bus ticket trying to get there. We cannot do that to people who need help from assault and rape and abuse.
We need protocol at universities as well as community colleges to make sure that people get the resources they need, especially people who are reaching out because of sexual assault and domestic violence. Their courage is the backbone of a prevention strategy. The gap this bill will fill is a void that exists as a hindrance to our community's growth. Put resources that save lives on our campuses so our sons and daughters don't fall victim to an increasing epidemic. If that door to the resource center had been down the hall from one of my classes, I could have walked in, asked for help, went somewhere private and cried and healed and eaten and found peace while making a plan with people who understood what was happening, people who met me where I was at, people who encouraged me to use the justice system. I eventually connected with Women's Space, where I found the resources I couldn't find on my campus. Being connected to those resources is the single most prominent reason I am halfway towards a bachelor's in planning, public policy, and management. We need to make sure that the journey to the resource is not impeded by a locked door or a lonely answering machine, because no one had a plan to make sure these people got what they needed when they needed it. It would be foolish to ignore the trends in sexual assault and domestic violence in college-age people and not respond with protective action. The prevention starts at connecting us survivors with resources. I urge you to remember us when voting on this bill. Thank you for hearing my testimony today, and I urge you to vote yes on Senate Bill 759.
Thank you.
All right. Good afternoon, Chairman Roblin and members of the committee. Thank you for having me here. This is my first time testifying and recognizing my penchant towards verbosity and your limited time. I actually provided myself with a script, so I apologize if I can't maintain that calm 101 level of eye contact right now. My name is Lena DeMorais, and I'm a second-year student at Lynn Benton Community College. I'm here to support Senate Bill 759 and share my story in the hopes that you will do the same. I'm a sexual assault survivor, and I suffer from rape-related post-traumatic stress disorder. Right now, I'm fortunate enough to go to a campus that provides the very services that we're urging in this bill. At my community college, I'm not just a name on a list. I'm a person with a story that faculty and staff have taken the time to get to know. But as an aspiring neuroscientist, I know that the majority of my academic career will take place on a university campus, and that scares me. I'm scared because I've heard firsthand from OSU students, including resident assistants, that there has been pushback with safe space training, that other survivors feel isolated from support networks, making the possibility of needing crisis intervention a terrifying ordeal. This bill addresses exactly the type of support systems people like me need. We need to know we are safe on campus. We need to know that when we are in crisis, there is someone who's trained to help us. Without these services, I know other survivors will be hesitant to come forward. We won't have those numbers to report. This bill is a way to protect us while we are on campus. These services, or lack thereof, can make or break our academic success. I urge you to support Senate Bill 759. Thank you for hearing my story, and if you have any questions regarding what we have at our community college, I'd be more than willing to answer.
Thanks to both of you for being here. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Ellie and Melinda Joy.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Melinda Joy, and I'm originally from Coos Bay, Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 759. I grew up on the outskirts of Coos County. My mother was a single parent of seven children who was not equipped to raise any of us. Eventually, I was placed in the foster care system. After I was released as a ward of the state at the age of 16, I made sure I completed my GED. And although I had no family support to support me or the resources to afford it, I made it to community college. While working on my degree, shortly before transferring to Portland State University, I was raped. A crime that is unforgivable in itself, but more pressing issue is coping with the effects that it left on me. I had a life and I wasn't about to stop living it, but my facade would only last for so long. A couple months after the assault, I was still waitlisted for a support group in the community and was hoping to get counseling services on campus once classes had started. However, the first available appointment, simply to evaluate what services they could offer me, was a month away. I was surprised, but I figured This must be expected, and figured there was nothing I could do. I'd wait patiently, and I would try to go make it through school the best I could. After my eventual evaluation, the Student Health and Counseling Center explained that I was complicated and that they weren't equipped to handle anything more than a 10 to 12 week transitional depression. The health center is made to handle things students commonly deal with, like depression, but not sexual assault. They suggested the WRC. I had classes, I had studying and a midterm to do. I had trauma to cope with and a life to try to stabilize. Resolved to find help, I made time. I approached the Women's Resource Center with some hesitation. I had not reported my experience yet, and I was cautious of talking with anyone who might escalate my situation. When I asked for resources for survivors, they pointed me towards a wall of unhelpful brochures, and then explained to me that they had an interpersonal violence coordinator. But that position seemed more like an advocate for domestic issues and not what I was looking for. One teacher attempted to make a good faith effort and gave a trigger warning for a video shown in my conflict resolution class. I hoped she might be able to help and explain my situation to her as clinically and detached as I possibly could. She was only a first year part-time teacher and didn't know much about the resources offered than I did. A few days later, she handed me a card with some numbers on it and advised me to go to the Women's Resource Center, wishing me luck. I didn't have the heart to tell her that I'd already been there. In spring term, with all the stress, I tried getting help from the Disabilities Resource Center, hoping to find someone I could finally confide in. After spending some time listening to me, they referred me to what Portland State University calls their care team, or rather a team of individuals who were supposed to be there to help support students in crisis. After a week, I received no contact. I went back to the DRC to check on my situation, and they didn't know. I'd received a voicemail shortly thereafter expressing concern, but beyond that, the care team did not contact me again. Ultimately, I made no progress. Throughout this entire year, I was unable to find services to help cope. A year in public university, and I still had not found the resources or the support to help me cope with the aftermath of being sexually assaulted. Once classes ended, I was able to invest the energy into finding the resources I needed, and I'm currently doing well. After my rape, even though I was continuously struggling with crippling anxiety and depression, and the overwhelming desire to give up, I was forced to put a smile on. Throughout the chaos of navigating the process, my life was not on hold. I held it together on my own through determination and the knowledge that I had nowhere to land without a college degree. Senate Bill 759 provides a step towards real accountability and establishes a minimum expectation of what higher education institutions must provide. The cost of not providing these resources is high. I persevered, but only through force of will. Many students drop out and we can keep that from happening. This state and this nation has invested in my education through federal and state grants. If this helps protect that investment, I encourage you all to support it. Providing this accountability is long overdue. And I would like to add that as a student at Portland State University who is very active and engaged on campus in regards to campus sexual assault, I'm willing to answer any questions on what we're able to do on campuses and what students have been doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Elle Mallon, Chair Rublin, members of the committee. I'm Elle Mallon. I'm a student at University of Oregon. At the beginning of this fall term, I was sexually assaulted. I knew I couldn't talk to the person who I would normally to find out what resources were available and what my rights were because she works for the school and is a mandatory reporter. At the time, I was taking a full course load and working two jobs with the university. I was spending 12 plus hours a day on campus. My entire life was on campus, and after I was assaulted, there was no one I could talk to about my experience or find resources because I knew I couldn't go to the police. This meant that as I tried to balance self-care, a full course load, and two jobs, I had no resources to help me get through. I didn't know what my rights were, and I didn't know how to try and find out without having to talk to the police. I didn't know if there was a way I could get support from my supervisors or professors to help me take a little bit of time for self-healing. I didn't know how to ask without forcing them to report. If I had a way to access anonymous reporting and received my rights, what was already a horrible and traumatic time could have been made easier by knowing what rights and resources there were for me, even if I couldn't go to the police. I didn't know where to reach out to resources, and I didn't know how to find what my resources were, let alone which ones I could access without having to go through the mandatory reporting process. Ultimately, due to the trauma of the event and the lack of resources available to me, I resigned from one of my jobs, knowing that without that income, I would need to find and take out private student loans, having already exhausted my financial aid. No future survivor of sexual assault should have to go through this. In a world after this bill, students at any college in Oregon would be able to have better access to resources, know their rights, and anonymously report sexual assault. If I had access to any one of these things, I would have maybe been able to get through that term without failing classes and resigning from my job. University action alone is not enough. Campuses are moving slowly, one at a time. It's never going to be enough to solve the problem. We need statewide action that makes sure that colleges have a basic level of support for survivors of sexual assault. I urge you to support Senate Bill 759 so colleges, universities, and community colleges across the state can be a little safer for students.
Thank you. Any questions? Appreciate it. And I appreciate you coming back.
Thank you.
Thanks. That's all the people who have signed up. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak to this bill who has not spoken yet? Seeing none. Just so those, yes.
Before you gavel out,
yep.
I just wanted to say thank you to everyone that came to speak today. I think going back to what we talked about before, the courage of people to stand up and talk about an event that was that traumatic in such a public way is an extraordinary thing. I can't begin to imagine how difficult that is. And legislation aside, I hope there are other people across the state watching and that your willingness to step forward will give them the courage to step forward and know that they're not alone and it's okay and they haven't done anything wrong and there's nothing that they did that made them deserve to walk through this experience. And you all helped them do that today. So thank you very much.
And I'd also like to say, just so you understand the process, we in this committee generally have a hearing like today. And then we close that hearing, and then in a future date, we bring up for a work session, which you saw earlier, so that it's not that we're not taking action today, though we aren't. It is that the process allows for us to look at what we've done. Senator Gelser's already said that she may have some tweaks to this bill or other things, and information that we gathered today might inform it even better. And so we'll figure out what needs to be done next, and then we'll be scheduling it again for a meeting in the future so that people understand that. And with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 759. Thank you all for your attendance. And now we might as well, we don't have all our people yet, so we'll go on to
856.
Senate Bill 856, a public hearing open. And Senator Knope, if you want to go down front, that would be great. Gelser set the standards, so you didn't have to. Senator Knope, would you like to have a short explanation of the bill before?
You bet.
Okay.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 856 establishes child sexual abuse prevention instructional programs for public schools. We are not considering any amendments at this time. This bill may have a fiscal impact, but a statement has not yet been issued, and there's no revenue.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Tim Knope, representing Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. I was contacted, I guess it was late last year, actually, by Erin Marin, and she has, just as we saw from many of the other folks who were testifying in committee, has gone from victim to activist to try to solve, I think, a significant issue, obviously, along the same lines, which is child sex abuse. And I think we all know the statistics on this. And so in looking at what she was trying to do, she has created kind of a law that she's passed in 21 states. It's called Aaron's Law. And we put together Senate Bill 856 that is very similar to her law. In working on research for this particular bill, I talked to my school district and others about what they do. And I think Oregon is ahead in many ways, ahead of other states in what they do in terms of child sex abuse training. So this has nothing to do with sex education. That's totally separate. So this is really, Aaron's Law teaches kids personal body safety, explaining to kids the difference between safe and unsafe touches, safe and unsafe secrets, and the area covered by your swimsuit is a place that nobody should touch unless your mom or dad are helping you wash or your doctor needs to check you, and so on. And so in looking at the kind of the research across the state, I think back in 2009, the legislature dealt with putting some training mandates in place for school districts as it relates to teachers and administrators and so on. And then I think probably through administrative rule sometime after that, there was instituted some child sex abuse training. And I think some of that is covered in what the bill tries to do. And so while we think as legislators that that always needs to be a bill, one of the reasons I decided to continue moving forward with the bill is because I want to make sure that not just my school district, but lots of other school districts as well are, you know, hopefully all of them have something in place that can really stem the tide of child sex abuse and help kids to, like as we heard earlier on these other bills, is to come forward and not to take the abuse and not to know that this isn't normal and that it's wrong and that they can safely report. And so really that's my goal, is to protect kids through this bill and through Aaron's Law, and I appreciate her contacting me, and I know that there are others who can testify as to what Oregon schools and school districts are doing and what the Department of Education has done as well. So be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions?
Well, just a comment. We've got kind of an overlap here. Among several of these bills, for example, on the last bill, I would like to also know what is going on at the community college level as well, as it just higher ed.
Yep.
And so I think we need to, we certainly need to do something. We just need to make sure we aren't going at cross directions with the different pieces of legislation.
Yep. Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much. We have somebody from ODE and OSBA to say a couple words, and I think it's about the same issue. So, Ellie Sanders and Lori Satinsville, with regard to what are we already doing, so we can kind of look at that and make sure that it... So, whoever wants to go first?
Good afternoon again.
This is the one you came for, by the way.
Senator Chair Roblin and the committee, I appreciate another opportunity to talk with you this afternoon. We were asked to provide some information. We, ODE, and let me back up. My name is Eli Sanders, and I'm the sexual health and school health specialist for the Department of Education. And so I have provided the committee a packet where I have attempted to clearly kind of provide a visual of what is already, at least in part, included in statute, as well as benchmarks. And just real quickly, benchmarks are really the path or guide teachers use to kind of develop curriculum and make sure that what they're teaching in the classroom aligns with state law, as well as standards. And so what has been talked about today with SB 856 as well as the other bills previously mentioned. There are segments that are covered already significantly in statute. ODE is neutral on this bill, and I, as well as ODE, is certainly willing and wanting to partner and work with looking and examining and discussing this. If we can, just real briefly, I'd like to go through the packet. The first page is a summary. It highlights what has been mentioned in Senator Knope's bill, as well as what's already present. And in more detail, the following document kind of puts everything side by side of where things exist. The shaded area are those benchmarks, which is the roadmap, again, for teachers as they look at curriculum, and as well as schools as they look at aligning K through 12. And which is important, especially with sex abuse prevention as well as violence prevention in general, that it's age appropriate. That was brought up earlier, good touch, bad touch. As well as what healthy relationships are, and that's outlined in the benchmarks provided. I included a document as well on health education standards. I want to highlight that health education standards are skills-based generally. The first standard one concepts, is a knowledge base where we present knowledge to children and youth. The predominantly, and for the next seven standards, we're looking at teaching kids and having them demonstrate skills, healthy skills that will empower them, provide safety, and encourage them to be healthy in a variety of areas. Sexual health is one of them that tends to cover this area of what we're talking about. And then I included the K through 3 benchmarks and standards for your reference, which includes good touch, bad touch, and some child abuse prevention, and what's currently on the books. So I'm available today as well as any time for questions and answers. So thank you.
Thank you. I just, and these standards are required of every school district.
Correct. Every school in the state of Oregon is required to provide comprehensive sex ed, as well as health education, kindergarten through 12th grade, age appropriate, best practice.
Thank Chair you. Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Boards. Again, supply all the policies required by law that help determine curriculum, what the district needs to be doing. And I think you've seen those all on OLIS. I think they're posted on OLIS. I'm just here to answer questions, and I did spend some time with Senator Knope on the bill, kind of talking about what went on in 2009 extensively under House Bill 2062, which was the major, pass the trash and how we get it, all of the issues going on there. Our liability risk management PACE has quite an extensive, from toolkits for administrators and teachers, amongst the two seg populations, and then grooming behavior is another big one that we provide education and training on through our PACE risk management. So I'd be happy to get any other materials, resources that you guys might want to take a look at.
Any questions? Yes, well, Senator Knope.
Just one. So you testified that health education and sex education are mandated. So is child sex abuse prevention training part of those, and so embedded in those curriculums? And is it therefore mandated for each school to do that as well?
Chair Roblin, Senator Knope, I'm sorry, Knope, I apologize. If you reference the packet that I put together, it highlights what was mentioned in Senate Bill 856 and where it's included in current statute as well as benchmarks. And so, yes, it's mandated. And one of my roles and significant roles is to work with districts to try and align what they're doing in the classroom as well as within kind of the presence of within their community of what of how best to align instruction and curriculum.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. There was no one else who had signed up to testify, so we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 856. And we have a couple more work sessions, so we will open a session on Senate Bill 932. And we'll have a short explanation, and then Senator Hatz.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 932 extends eligibility for receiving Oregon financial aid scholarships and grants to certain students who qualify for exemption from paying non-resident tuition. It removes requirements that certain students must enroll at public universities within 3 years of graduating high school or graduate from public university within 5 years of initial enrollment to be entitled to exemption from non-resident tuition and fees at public universities. A fiscal impact has been issued for Senate Bill 932 with the -1 amendments. LFO has requested a further fiscal analysis and a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Senate Bill 932 with the -1 amendments has no revenue impact.
We're in work session. Chair Roblin.
Senator Hass.
I move to adopt the -1 amendments as presented.
Senator Hass moves to adopt the -1 amendments as presented. Is there any discussion on the -1 amendments? Seeing none, they are adopted. Senator Hass.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 932 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Hass moves Senate Bill 932 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? We'll take a roll call vote on this one. So. Oh, he is here if he needs it. No? Okay, we'll take a roll call vote.
Yes.
Senator Gelser?
Yes.
Senator Hatz?
Yes.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Slash their note?
No.
And
yes. Bill passes. Senator Bert Sugar is excused. If he comes back, I'll give him the opportunity to vote, which he wants to. And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 932. And we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 44. And with that, short explanation and then Senator.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 44 extends the sunset for tax credits for University Venture Development Fund contributions. We are considering the -2 amendments at this time. This bill does have a subsequent referral to tax credits. No fiscal impact has been issued for Senate Bill 44 with the -2 amendments, and a revenue statement has been issued for Senate Bill 44 with the -2 amendments. Further analysis will be required in tax credits.
In tax credits, okay.
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the -2 amendments as presented.
Senator Canope moves to adopt the -2 amendments as presented. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any opposition to the -2 amendments? Seeing none, they are adopted. Senator Canope.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 44 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Mm-hmm. Senator Canope moves Senate Bill 44 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, yes. Mr. Chair, I think this is probably the first bill that's been referred to that committee, isn't it? I mean, you're going to have absolutely nothing to do down there.
It's our second. Yeah. I think there are some coming from other places. Any other discussion? Is there any opposition to this bill? Seeing none, it is moved and
just
off to
money.
Senator Hass's committee, and I think that takes care of our business for the day. So I don't think there's any other business. We got close to time. Thank you, Senator Gelser, for the move with the other bill. Made it work out today, so thank you.
You're most welcome. I'm next meeting.
Oh, is there a question? We've missed a couple meetings because of long times on the floor. We have a lot of bills. Some will get knocked off if we don't. Do you want us to schedule a separate meeting on a Friday afternoon, 1 to 3?
Or
As we get closer, we may run out of bills. We may run out of time for bills. So are you guys willing to do a Friday afternoon, 1 to 3? Or just a discussion? But it won't be this Friday. I'll give you some time and some dates to look at. But
That would be acceptable.
Okay.
We could all volunteer to pull bills.
Yeah, okay, I'll let you talk about that. We'll let you have a conversation about that, sure.
Well, we could do that. It's straight to the floor. We've been trying that, and it hasn't worked very well so far.
With that. We'll adjourn our meeting in the Senate Education Committee today. Thank you. Thank you.